Good afternoon, everyone, and Laura, thank you for that introduction. Thank you for the invitation to join you at the National Press Club. This is the third time I've had the privilege of addressing the National Press Club, but as you say, the first time in Canberra. So it's great to be in Canberra for the first time here, but it's particularly great to be able to travel to Canberra. I haven't been able to do that for a while, so I enjoyed coming here today. The world has changed tremendously since my previous address to the press club in February last year. We've had a pandemic, the biggest contraction in output in generations, the closure of our borders, very substantial fiscal stimulus, near zero interest rates, and quantitative easing by the central bank. All that in just a year, and none of it was predicted. It was therefore with some nervousness and trepidation that I titled my remarks today, The Year Ahead. I did so though because at the start of the new year, I thought it was important that I set out our thinking about the Australian economy and our thinking about monetary policy over the next year or so. But before I do that, I want to offer three observations on the year that has just passed. The first is that Australians respond well in a crisis. And I think collectively, we should be proud of that. The second is that the economic downturn was not as deep as we initially feared, and the bounce back has been earlier and stronger than we're expecting. And the third is that as we start 2021, there's still quite a long way to go before we reach our goals for full employment and inflation consistent with the target. I'd like to elaborate on each of these observations because they're quite relevant to thinking about the future. First, our national response. As a community, we've pulled together in the common good, and we have been prepared to do what's necessary to contain the virus. Our public administration and health systems have worked well in the public interest. Governments responded quickly to the pandemic, and decisive fiscal and monetary responses have helped many people in the community. Our banks have worked well with their customers to help them meet their obligations. And because of these collective efforts, Australia is in a much better place than most other countries. And that's true for both the economy and the health situation. I think most of us feel we're much better off being in Australia than any other place in the world. The second observation is that despite the pandemic having very significant economic costs, the downturn was not as deep as we thought it was going to be, and the recovery has started earlier, and it's been stronger than we're expecting. Employment growth has been strong recently, as have retail sales and house building. And across many indicators, including GDP, the outcomes have been better than our central forecasts, and many of the outcomes have been better than our upside scenarios as well. So there's a lot of positive news there. Because I'm from the Reserve Bank, I have some pictures, and I'm going to show you an illustration of how things have turned out better than was expected. In August last year, our central forecast was that the unemployment rate would end 2020 at close to 10% and still be above 7% at the end of next year. As you can see in the upside scenario, the unemployment rate was expected to end last year a little lower than 10%. But even in the upside scenario, it was still expected to be around 7% later this year. Thankfully, the actual outcomes for unemployment have been much better than this. The peak in the unemployment rate now looks to be behind us. It was 7.5%, and we ended last year with an unemployment rate of 6.6%. I think it's reasonable to ask what explains these better than expected economic outcomes. I want to point to three factors. The first is the success that Australia's had in containing the virus. That success has meant that the activity restrictions have been less disruptive than we feared. It's allowed more of us to get back to work sooner, and it's reduced some of the economic scarring from the pandemic. As is increasingly clear from our experience in Australia and the experience elsewhere around the world, the health of the population and the health of the economy are inextricably linked. The second factor explaining these better than expected outcomes is the very significant fiscal policy support in Australia, which you can see in this next chart, if we measure the change in the budget position, or the change in the budget position, it's almost equivalent to 15% of GDP. That's a very strong fiscal support. It's bigger than what we've seen in many other countries. Most of this support has been delivered by the Australian government, but the states and territories have also played an important role. This support has been more substantial than we assumed in August when we put our forecast together at that time. This support has provided a welcome boost to incomes and jobs, and it's helped front-load the recovery by creating incentives for people to bring forward their spending. There's also been a positive interaction here with the health outcomes, which have allowed the policy support to gain more traction than would have been the case if the health outcomes hadn't been as positive as they were. The third factor is that Australians adapted and innovated. When the virus first came to our shores, many people understandably hunkered down. But as the days wore on, we adjusted and we changed what we did and how we did it. This resilience has helped keep the economy going and it's kept many people in jobs. Many firms changed their business models, they moved online, they used new technologies, they reconfigured their supply lines. Households have adjusted too, with spending patterns changing very significantly. Some of the spending that we would normally have done on international travel, on entertainment, has been redirected to other areas, including electrical goods, homewares, and for some people, home renovations. Online spending has also surged, and as you can see in this next chart, online spending was up 70% over the past year. These changes in our spending patterns have been challenging for many businesses, but the ability and the willingness of Australians to keep spending has helped the overall economy and it's kept people in jobs. My third observation about the year just passed is that despite these positive economic outcomes, we still have quite a way to go. There is still very substantial spare capacity in the Australian economy. The unemployment rate today is higher than it has been for almost two decades, and there are many people in our community who can't get the hours of work that they want. And in terms of output, we remain well behind where we thought we would be when I spoke to the press club in February last year. As you can see in this next chart, when the national accounts are published for the December quarter, they are likely to show that the level of GDP is 4% lower than where we thought it would be a year ago. 4%, it's a big number. There's a big gap there. On the nominal side of the economy, there's also a fair way to go. In underlying terms, inflation's running at 1.25%. It's obviously well below the 2-3% medium-term target we have. And wages growth, as you can see in this chart, is the lowest that it's been in decades. It's running at just 1.4%. Given the spare capacity that currently exists in the economy, we're expecting that these low rates of inflation and wage increases are likely to be with us for some time, in fact, for some years. So this brings me now to the year ahead. In my view, we can draw some comfort from the year that's just passed. Our ability to pull together and the earlier expected bounce back are both positive developments, and they provide a basis for confidence about the future. Yet even so, the path ahead is likely to be bumpy and it's likely to be uneven, and it will be some time before we're back to full employment and have inflation back to the target. As was the case last year, much depends upon the path of the pandemic. The development of vaccines in record time is clearly good news, and it's reduced one of the big uncertainties that, and it could provide the foundation for a vigorous and robust sustainable recovery in the global economy. But this outcome is not assured. The global rollout of the vaccines faces very significant challenges, and there are still a range of other uncertainties around the global economy, including the ongoing trade tensions. Sure, we all hope for the best here, but we also need to be prepared for further setbacks in what remains a highly uncertain world. The RBA will be releasing a full set of updated on of economic forecasts on Friday when we release the statement on monetary policy. But today I can give you the key numbers. In preparing these forecasts, we've assumed a rollout of the vaccines in line with the current government guidance. And we've also assumed that international travel remains highly restricted for Australians for the rest of this year. Our central scenario is that the upswing in the Australian economy continues with above-trend growth over the next couple of years, as you can see in this chart. GDP is expected to increase by 3.5% both this year and next. And given the recovery that we've had so far, we're now expecting the level of GDP to return to its end 2019 level by the middle of this year. And that's 6 to 12 months earlier than we were expecting not so long ago. Notwithstanding this recovery, we are not expecting the level of GDP to return to its previous trend over the forecast period. And that's largely because of lower population growth. When we prepared the forecast a year ago, we were expecting population growth to average 1.6% last year and this year. And as you can see in this chart, the actual outcome is going to be much lower than that. And in 2021, we're now expecting the population to grow by just 0.2%. That would be the smallest increase since World War I, when Australian soldiers left to fight in Europe. This slower population growth has a direct effect on the size of our economy, and it means that we will not get back to the previous trend for GDP anytime soon. In per capita terms, the story is more positive. We expect to get back, but not fully back, we expect to get mostly back, but not fully back to where we were expected to be before. But in terms of the overall size of the economy, it will be smaller because population growth is smaller. In the labour market, we're expecting the rate of unemployment to continue to decline. In the central scenario, the unemployment rate's expected to reach 6% by the end of this year and around 5.25% by mid-23. Job vacancies, job ads, and hiring intentions at the moment are all at quite high levels, and that suggests continuing solid employment growth over the months ahead. Beyond that, some slowing in employment growth is expected when the JobKeeper program comes to an end in March, but we expect the unemployment rate to trend down over the course of this year. Given this outlook, including the high unemployment rate, we're expecting wages growth and inflation to remain subdued. In the central scenario, wages growth is forecast to pick up from its current low rate, but to do so only very gradually and still be below 2% at the end of next year, still be very, very low. Consistent with this and the ongoing spare capacity in the economy, inflation in underlying terms is also forecast to stay below 2% over the next couple of years. The central forecast for 21 is for inflation to be 1.25%, and for 2022, inflation is expected to be just 1.5%. In headline terms, though, inflation is expected to spike to around 3% in the June quarter, and this largely reflects the swings in the prices of childcare and some other administered prices. But after the spike, we expect to see headline inflation to return to below 2%. So that is a broad outline of the central scenario. On Friday, we will also be publishing downside and upside scenarios as we did through the course of last year. The downside scenario is one in which there's a combination of further sporadic domestic outbreaks, a delay in the rollout of vaccines, and a worsening global outlook. The upside involves further good news on the health front and a strong pickup in consumer and business spending, which propels a strong self-sustaining recovery. This is especially so in the light of the very large amount of fiscal and monetary stimulus that's currently in place. In the downside scenario, further progress in reducing unemployment is delayed and it's very limited, and there is also very little pickup in wages growth or inflation from current levels. In the upside scenario, though, the unemployment rate falls faster, and it's expected to be a bit below 5% in the second half of next year. So that would be quite a good outcome if we can achieve it. I want to highlight two specific issues that we've been working through as we've put the forecast together. The first is how households respond over coming months to the tapering of the fiscal and other support measures. Unusually for an economic downturn, growth in household income has been quite strong over the past year, as you can see in this chart. This largely reflects the support provided by fiscal policy. Much of this extra income has been saved, with the household saving rate surging to 22% in the June quarter. This extra saving largely reflects the limited spending opportunities during the lockdown, but it's also a response to the uncertainty that people felt about the future. When people are uncertain, they tend to save more and spend less. These extra savings have strengthened household balance sheets, and they mean that many people now have bigger financial buffers than they had previously. So the question here is, what comes next? As you can see in this chart, over the next 6 months, aggregate household income is expected to decline as the pandemic support payments unwind. And normally, when income falls, so does consumption. But we're not in normal times. The extra savings over the past 6 months and the bigger financial buffers that people have can support future spending. People will also have more freedom to spend as restrictions are eased. I think they'll be more willing to spend as uncertainty eases. So we are expecting the recovery in consumer spending to continue. But there are risks to the forecast in both directions here. On the downside, further bad news on the health front or the jobs front could see people restrain their spending again. We could see additional restrictions and increased uncertainty as people want to save more. But on the upside, positive news on the health and jobs fronts could see people seek to catch up on their spending, and they could seek to run down the extra savings, the extra buffers that they've built up over the past year. If that were to be the case, we would see a stronger pickup in the economy than our central scenario. So this is an area we're watching very carefully. One other important factor bearing on household spending is the housing market. When I spoke in Sydney at the National Press Club last year, I discussed how falling housing prices in 2019 was one of the main factors explaining the sluggish economy during 2019. It was all about housing prices declining, and that was hurting the economy. The dynamics of the housing market are now different, and prices across most of the country are now increasing. You can see this in my next chart. It remains to be seen how long these increases will continue, but sustainable increases in asset prices do support household balance sheets, and they encourage spending through positive wealth effects. Higher housing prices can also encourage additional residential construction and support the economy that way. But as housing prices rise again, we will be monitoring lending standards very closely. We would be concerned if there were to be a deterioration in these lending standards, but there are few signs of this at the moment. The second specific issue I wanted to highlight is the outlook for investment. Prior to the pandemic, there were already concerns about the protracted period of low investment, particularly in the non-mining business sector. If you look at this graph, I think you can see why we had been concerned. Not surprisingly, when the pandemic hit, business investment declined further. Faced with a more uncertain environment and with a drop in demand, many firms deferred their investment plans and they sought to de-risk their balance sheets, so they slowed their capital spending. And on a more positive note, as you can see in this chart, there's been a welcome offsetting pickup in public investment, which is, as it should do, playing a strong counter-cyclical role at the moment. We are yet to see the same signs of a recovery in private investment that we've seen in household spending. We're still waiting for this. Investment is, though, expected to pick up as uncertainty recedes and demand increases. This increase in private business investment is not only needed to support the economic recovery, but it's also needed to build the productive capital stock that we need for our future. So this too is an issue that we're watching very carefully. I would now like to turn to the outlook for monetary policy. At our meeting yesterday, the Reserve Bank Board reviewed the monetary policy measures announced last year and also reviewed the outlook for the year ahead. And I'd like to share six conclusions of that review with you. The first conclusion is that last year's monetary policy package is working broadly as expected, and it's supporting the economy and helping support jobs. Together, the bond purchases, the term funding facility, the three-year yield target, the record low cash rate have kept funding costs low for all borrowers, and they've helped ensure that the banking system is able to provide the credit that is needed for the recovery. These measures have also resulted in a lower value of the Australian dollar than would have otherwise been the case. Combined, the various measures have resulted in the RBA's balance sheet increasing from around $180 billion to currently $330 billion, and we're expecting further substantial increases to take place over the months ahead. The second conclusion from our review is that the very significant monetary support we have at the moment will need to be maintained for some time to come. It's going to be some years before our goals for inflation and unemployment are achieved, so it's premature to be considering withdrawal of monetary stimulus. The third conclusion is that we will continue to purchase bonds issued by the Australian government and by the states and territories at the completion of the current bond purchase program in mid-April. In reaching this conclusion, the board considered three factors. The first was the effectiveness of the bond purchases to date. The second was the actions of other central banks. And the third and most important consideration was the outlook for inflation and jobs. With 3 months' experience now on the bond purchase program, it's clear that these bond purchases have helped to lower interest rates, and they have meant the Australian dollar is lower than it otherwise would have been. So it's worked. Australian government bond markets also continue to function well, and the available evidence is that further purchases would not be a source of market dysfunction. In terms of other central banks, most other central banks have recently announced extensions of their bond purchase program, with some of these programs running until at least the end of this year. Given this, if we were to cease bond purchase in April, it's likely that there would be unwelcome upward pressure on the exchange rate. So that was a factor in our decision-making as well. And in terms of the most important consideration, the outlooks for inflation and jobs, as I've mentioned a few times already, we remain well short of our goals, and we're likely to be short of our goals for some years to come. Given these considerations and the fact that the cash rate is at its effective lower bound, the board decided to purchase another $100 billion of government bonds at the completion of the current program. These additional purchases will be at the rate of $5 billion a week, which is unchanged from the current program, and other parameters of the current program will remain unchanged as well. These bond purchases will ensure a continuation of the RBA's monetary support for the Australian economy in its recovery phase. The fourth conclusion from our review on Tuesday is that the term funding facility will be maintained as it is. Banks are able to draw on this facility up until the end of June, which means they will have the benefit of low-cost funding out to the middle of 2024. The board would consider extending this facility if there were a marked deterioration in funding and credit conditions in the Australian financial system. At the moment, though, there are no signs of this. Our markets and our financial system are working well. The fifth conclusion is that the three-year yield target for Australian government bonds will be maintained. This target has helped anchor the Australian yield curve, and it's reinforced our forward guidance regarding the cash rate. Later in the year, the board will need to consider whether to shift the focus of the yield target from the April 24 bond to the November 24 bond. In considering this issue, the board will be giving close attention to the flow of economic data and the outlooks for inflation and jobs. It's made no decision on this issue yet. The final conclusion is that the cash rate will be maintained at 10 basis points for as long as is necessary. As I've said previously, the board has no appetite to go into negative territory, and it's done as much as it reasonably can do with interest rates. Before increasing the cash rate, the board wants to see inflation sustainably within the 2 to 3% target range. It's not enough for it to be forecast to be in that range. We want to actually see it sustainably within that range. Meeting this condition for an increase in the cash rate will require a tighter labour market and stronger wages growth than we're currently forecasting. It's difficult to determine exactly when this condition might be met, but based on the outlook I've shared with you today, we do not expect it to be before 2024, and it's possible that it'll be later than this. So the message is interest rates are going to be low for quite a while yet. The Reserve Bank is committed to provide the support the economy needs as it recovers from the pandemic. We want to see the unemployment rate come down, we want to get back to full employment, and we want to get the inflation target achieved. So we will keep doing what we're doing until we achieve those goals. On that note, I wish you all the best for the year ahead. Let's hope it's a bit more predictable. Thank you for listening, and I look forward to answering your questions.
Well, thanks so much for that, Dr. Lowe. You talked about the board's hope of getting inflation back up to 2 to 3% on a sustainable basis, which for those of us with long memories seems like a pretty bizarre place to be. And you also focused on a number of occasions about the low rate of wages growth, which is at an all-time low. The wage price index is at an all-time low. Obviously, there's little the Reserve Bank can do directly about wages, but in recent years, you've been willing, in public if need be, to advise the government of the need for further infrastructure and fiscal spending, as well as further microeconomic reform. Is it time you also advise the government to do more on wages growth and the balance of power in the labour market?
No, I'm not going to provide the government with advice on that vexed issue. I think our main contribution here is to keep the monetary support going as long as is reasonably possible. And my hope is by doing that, people will get jobs, the unemployment rate will come down, the labour market will tighten, and as it tightens, wage increases will rise. I have some confidence that process will work, but I'm also realistic enough to know that it's going to take a long time. Remember, before the pandemic, we were seeing tightness in some pockets of the labour market, and wages in those pockets were starting to move. So that gives me confidence that the laws of supply and demand in the labour market still work. So our strategy is to make sure that there's strong demand for labour, the economy is growing strongly, and eventually firms start paying higher wages because they want the workers. Obviously, the government's programs are helping in some of those areas. But for our part, we're going to keep the monetary support going until people have jobs and firms have to pay higher wages to get the workers they need. And I'm confident that that will eventually work, but we have to be patient.
The next question is from Jennifer Duke.
Thank you very much for taking my question today. The government has decided to tie public wages to private wages. Given the low wage growth environment that we're in, won't that actually be a deterrent to sort of wages growth across the economy?
Oh, it depends which way you think the causation runs here. I think kind of as a longer term structural feature, as long as you think the relativities between public sector and private sector wages are okay, that they should over the long term increase at the same rate, shouldn't they? So as a principle, I can understand where they're coming from. My aspiration is for both public and private sector wages to be growing faster than they currently are. And our strategy is really the one I just articulated in response to Laura's question. Get strong demand for labour, and then both government and private businesses have to pay higher wages to get the good workers they want. The quicker that happens, the better. But it's going to take some time, isn't it?
The next question is from Patrick Commons from The Australian.
Hi, Governor. Patrick Commons from The Australian newspaper. Your upside scenario has unemployment rate going below 5% second half of next year, which means it could be in the low fives beginning of next year. Given that the Treasurer has said that, you know, when unemployment rate's comfortably below 6%, that we're in the task of budget repair, next May's budget, well, not the coming one, but the following one, could be one of tighter fiscal policy, in which case, are you concerned that tighter fiscal policy could complicate your task of getting inflation rate back to 2 and 3%? You'll have fiscal and monetary policy potentially working at cross purposes again.
Well, there are a lot of conditions in that question, yes, aren't there? You've got to kind of achieve the upside scenario. The government's got to respond to that with tight fiscal policy. And So it's not my business to be kind of commenting on hypotheticals. All I can say is that what we've seen in the past year is the fiscal response has been incredibly important in the recovery of the economy. It's helped across a whole range of dimensions, and I've welcomed publicly what the federal government has done and what the state and territory governments have done. I think they've done the right thing by the country. We've had to borrow more to do this, and I think it's been exactly the right thing to do, to borrow against our future income. I'm hoping that they'll continue to respond in the same flexibility in the future. If we need extra fiscal support, I hope we get it, but I think it's too early to be speculating about what might happen in the middle of next year. We've got to get through this year's budget, haven't we?
Matthew Cranston.
Governor Matt Cranston, Fin Review. Are central banks around the world in a cold war on currency at the moment? It seems to me that regardless of how fast the domestic recovery happens in Australia, you're going to have to be doing QE for years. And with all that cheap money around, do you really think we're not going to get dangerous asset price bubbles in things like houses or stocks like GameStop?
Now, quite a lot of elements to that question. Are the central banks in a cold war? The answer to that is no. Every month I'm meeting with the governors of the other major central banks and we discuss this issue. We understand that part of the transmission mechanisms through the exchange rate. No one wants to see in the current environment their exchange rate really go up by that much. So if some central banks are doing quantitative easing, most of the rest of us feel like we need to do that as well. Otherwise, our currency will go up. So it's not a kind of, we don't think about this as a war. It's just how monetary policy is transmitted to the real economy. Are we going to be doing this for years? I hope not. I don't expect we will need to do it for years. As I said, the central outlook we have is for further progress towards our goals, and if we make that progress at some point, it'll be appropriate to do something different. Am I worried about asset prices rising too quickly? At the moment, not especially so. Now, there's a lot of focus at the moment on the fact that housing prices are rising again, and the stock market's been strong as well. But the National House Price Index today is where it was 4 years ago. So we've had no net increase in national housing prices over the past 4 years. And the capital city price index is lower than it was 4 years ago. In regional Australia, it's a bit higher. And in the equity market, we're not even back to where we were at the beginning of last year. So I find it hard at the moment to express concerns about at least the developments in asset prices to date. It's possible that housing prices could rise further, but there are also factors working in the opposite direction, aren't there? That population growth is said the lowest since 1916. The rate of new home building at the moment, house building, is the highest in decades. We've still got falling rents for apartments in Sydney and Melbourne. So there are a lot of dynamics going on here. At the moment, I don't see anything that's unsustainable. The issue for us would be if, on the back of rising housing prices in particular, people were borrowing a lot of money and they weren't doing that sensibly. And APRA, and with the assistance of the Council of Financial Regulators, showed a few years ago, if that were to happen, we're prepared to step in. So there are a lot of elements to that question. I hope I addressed most of them.
Andrew Probyn.
Dr. Lowe, Andrew Probyn from the ABC. As your speech was indicating, there's a lot of the economic recovery depends on the vaccine rollout. What work have you and your colleagues been doing on vaccine hesitancy, and what concerns would you have well-known Australians, including elected officials, were to act in a way that would cast doubt on the efficacy of vaccines?
We haven't done any particular work on kind of whether the population is going to take a vaccine in large enough quantities, but that's not my area of expertise. We take the advice from the government, and I noticed the Prime Minister, when he was asked a similar question earlier in the week, said he takes his medical advice from his doctor.
Would you thoroughly encourage the same?
I would certainly. Well, that's where I take my medical advice from the doctor. I'm not a big YouTuber or social media person, so I generally would go to the doctor, and to the extent that advice is transferable to other people, I think it would be sensible. It's not in my area of expertise. We just take the government's plans for rollout, and we factor those into our forecasts. The bigger issue is kind of, I think, a global one. The advanced economies will get a fairly high share of their population vaccinated fairly soon, but there'll be many other countries where that won't be the case. If that's the situation, will the international borders open up? Will we find a way of doing that safely? The closure of the borders, while it affects individuals, you know, they can't see their families and they can't travel, it's also affecting businesses. I know quite a few businesses, when asked why they're not investing, they say, well, we can't get the technical specialists from Germany or the US to come in and put in place the plant or do the software. A lot of stuff can be done by Zoom now, but not everything can. Kind of commissioning a new plant and some type of technology work can't be. So if we can get the vaccines globally, then we'll be able to open up the borders, and I think that'll give firms another reason to invest. But we don't do any particular work on this issue.
Chloe Boris from Network 10.
Chloe Boris from Network 10. Could you please explain in the simplest terms, perhaps keeping in mind your audience outside of this room, when the RBA decides to purchase government bonds as it's doing, where does the RBA get that money from? Is it simply a matter of printing new money? How does it work?
Well, it's not it's not printing money. People think of it as printing money because once upon a time, if the central bank bought an asset, it might pay for that asset by giving you notes, you know, bank notes. So you'd have to print. I'd have to run my printing process to do it. We don't operate that way anymore, obviously, because we live in an electronic world. When we buy a bond from a bank, the way we pay for that is credit the bank's. We use Westpac, it's the sponsor of today's event. If we bought a bond from Westpac, we would credit Westpac's account at the Reserve Bank. And that creates the money electronically. That's how a modern system works. And then Westpac could use that money, hopefully, to make some loans to some of its customers. But we can create money electronically, and that's what we do these days.
Thank you.
The central bank is the only one who can do that. That's the unique feature of a central bank, and that's why you want, this is my final point here, that's why you want a lot of governance over the process of doing that. You wouldn't want everyone to be able to do this, would you? So you've got a governance, you've got kind of strong board with a mandate, legal responsibilities, and we take it incredibly seriously. And, you know, we're laughing now, but it's not something we take lightly. We take it incredibly seriously, and we know we're doing this in the national interest, but it's a heavy responsibility to be able to just create money like that.
Dr. Lowe, Ross Greenwood, Sky News. Just on that subject as well, given the debt that's being accumulated through government, given, of course, the very low inflation, it is one of your scenarios, low growth, low investment. Is it one of those things where Australians need to prepare their children and grandchildren for the fact that they might be less well off than what their parents' generation were, simply because there are not the opportunities, because government is curtailed into the future? Is this something that you try and explain, say, for example, to your children when you go home and explain to them what you've done at the office that day?
No, I certainly don't prepare them to have lower living standards than I have. I talk to them about the importance of education, about the tremendous opportunities the country has across a whole range of areas. I see fantastic things happening on the digital economy, tremendous opportunities in energy, So I talked to them about opportunity and technology, because I think in the end that's going to drive stronger living standards in Australia. The two things that are really important for our future prosperity are developing new technologies, because that drives living standards, and developing our human capital. I sometimes say to my kids when I'm in lecture mode, Australia became really wealthy and prosperous largely from what was in the soil and what we could grow in the soil, kind of over the last 200 years. Over the next 200 years, it's going to be what comes out of here, not what comes out of the land. So make sure, I tell my kids to study all the time, which they do, and to understand technology, and they'll drive better living standards for them.
Peter Martin.
G'day, Peter Martin, the conversation. A more technical question. You're targeting the three-year bond rate. That's the anchor, you say. Yet the 10-year bond rate is creeping up. At the end of last year, it was just below 1%. I think today's auction, it was 1.14. Latest survey of economists has it increasing over the next 2 years to 1.5. Is this a good thing? A sign that maybe there's some optimism about the economy in the future and government's need for cash? Or is this a bad thing and something that, in order to keep a lid on interest rates, on the cost of money, you're going to have to maybe consider extending out your target, maybe targeting 10-year bonds?
We're not considering moving in that direction. I don't think it's a good or a bad thing. It's just a thing. Bond yields are rising around the world, and our yields have risen because the US yields have risen. And why has that happened over the past month? It's largely because of the rapid development of the vaccines. People are more optimistic about the future, about the next couple of years in terms of global growth than they were last year. And when they're more optimistic, the bond yields tend to rise. So it's a kind of, it's a reflection of a bit more optimistic tone, and I hope that is end up being validated.
But you're prepared to sit on that reflection for the three-year bond, not for the 10-year? You're prepared to suppress that.
You can think of the three-year rate as being the expected cash rate over the next 3 years. And I hope you took one of the messages you took away from what I said is the cash rate's going to be where it is probably for the next 3 years. And if the cash rate's there for the next 3 years, then the three-year bond yield should be the same, the 10 basis points. So that's perfectly consistent. I really hope the cash rate isn't where it is for the next 10 years. And I don't expect it will be, because I expect technology and human capital and the resilience of Australians to kind of drive a recovery in which we'll be able to gradually and slowly, carefully return interest rates to normal, but probably not in the next 3 years.
Colin
but
Brinston.
In the next 10 years, sometimes.
Yes.
Colin Brinston, AAP. You expect employment growth to slow when JobKeeper comes off in March. Given your aim for employment or unemployment, are you a bit disappointed that the government is ending that scheme so soon, particularly as you're going to great efforts to make money as cheap as possible for them?
Well, I think when JobKeeper ends, there will be some job shedding. That surely will happen. But that's going to take place in the context of an economy that's otherwise recovering. And there's quite a lot of job creation going on at the moment. Job ads, job vacancies and business hiring intentions coming out of the surveys and in our own business layers and saying firms want to hire workers. So there's that kind of dynamic occurring, and the recovery in aggregate jobs will slow temporarily when the JobKeeper program comes to an end. If you look carefully enough at my graphs, you'll see kind of the unemployment rate stops falling for a while, and it's possible it could rise a bit for a month or two. But given the ongoing recovery in the economy, we expect the unemployment rate to keep coming down. Am I disappointed the government's stopping the JobKeeper program? No. And the government made it very clear this was a temporary program. It's been an incredibly important program. It's saved many people their jobs and helped people in their lives. So it's been incredibly important. It was only ever meant to be temporary. And given the recovery of the economy, I can understand why the government wants to stop that program, as they said wouldn't perhaps have a discussion about whether there's an opportunity for more focused support in those industries which are still feeling very difficult conditions, and it's largely people associated with international travel and major events. We always want to keep these support measures, people want to keep these support measures going, but it was only designed to be temporary, wasn't it? At some point we've got to stop it, and the economy is actually on a reasonable track at the moment.
Consolidate that point, you're seeing JobKeeper coming off as part of perhaps a blip in the economy rather than a cliff in the economy.
Yeah, at the moment we're seeing it very much in terms of something that will slow the decline in the unemployment rate temporarily. I mean, it's quite possible we have a month or two where the unemployment rate blips up, but we've got to remember that this is being withdrawn in the context of an economy that is recovering. You saw from my graphs on the unemployment rates come down a lot quicker than we thought, and in all the high-frequency indicators of what's going on in the labour market and when we talk to businesses, our sense is that this job creation is going to continue. And I'm hoping that that will be enough to offset the job losses from the ending of the JobKeeper program. But it's something that there's a degree of uncertainty around. Of course, we haven't been in this area before, so we don't have any experience to draw on. It's possible it could go the other way, but the central scenario is that we continue to recover.
Mark Kenny.
Dr. Lowe, Mark Kenny from the National Press Club Board and the ANU. You've just really effectively answered the question I was about to ask you about JobKeeper. So sure. I might refer you back to my friend Andrew Probyn's question. One of the lessons of this, which I'm sure you would agree with, is that of this whole management of this period has been that if you get the health side of it right, the economy is protected through that process. That's been really Australia's achievement here. And therefore, any questions about the vaccine, which is the next stage of this and upon which a great deal of confidence rests, including all of those business investment decisions you were talking about, the vaccine is fundamentally important. It does rather rankle, I think, for some people to be paying for both the PR exercise in building confidence and the salary of MPs who are running down that confidence and creating questions. Do you see the question of the vaccine itself, how effective it is and what the take-up is, as a risk factor in the economy? Is that something that you are considering as one of the variables for the recovery?
Not particularly. I'm starting from the proposition that most Australians are very sensible. They'll do the right thing. You know, we've seen that over the past year. I remember when the pandemic first hit, and I was in Saudi Arabia at a G20 meeting with the Treasurer, and we saw that China was locking down its cities, and we were kind of speculating whether that was even possible in a democracy. Well, we now know it is. I mean, Australians, while they weren't very happy about it, they did it, and we didn't complain. We've actually done the right thing. So it's kind of this resilience, this desire to do the right thing by the community is very strong in our ethos. And I'm confident that will continue, and that most people will get vaccinated, as I think they should, and as I certainly will. I think that's how the vast bulk of Australians will respond to this. And that's going to be enough. You know, certainly some people won't want to get vaccinated and they'll have concerns, but I think enough of us will get vaccinated. I have enough confidence in Australians.
Thank you.
Paul Karp.
Paul Karp from Guardian Australia. Thanks very much. You've given your thoughts on JobKeeper, but could I please ask similarly if the JobSeeker coronavirus supplement is not extended, how large will the macroeconomic impact of that be? And do you see a case for making a permanent increase to unemployment benefits?
We haven't modelled kind of the consequences of going back to the previous New Start levels, but I think there's a wide consensus in the community that the previous level should be increased permanently. And I've said on previous occasions that I would join that consensus. Whether the government decides to do that, it's entirely up to them. It's a government and fiscal policy issue. But I can see the arguments for a permanent increase. And the government obviously will have to make a decision before, I think it's the end of March, isn't it, when the current supplement runs out.
And sorry, just on the macroeconomic impact if it isn't extended.
We, I, I'm not aware that, of any particular modelling we've done. It would obviously have some effect because these people who are getting their supplement, the vast bulk of them spend the bulk of the income they get, so there'd be some effect on spending. But for me, it's not really kind of a macroeconomic management issue. It's kind of a fairness issue and what's the appropriate level of support we should provide to people who are unemployed. That's my prism. I mean, it's not a macroeconomic prism. It would obviously have some macroeconomic effect, but that's not the first order issue, is it? As a society, what level of support do we want to provide people who don't have a job? And different people will legitimately have different views about the level of support. My own view is that some increase is justifiable.
Lani Scar.
Lani Scar from the West Australian. Thank you for your speech. How much do you think the current China trade tensions are impacting our economy? And do you have a forecast for how long you think it will take until that's repaired? Can it be repaired between Australia and China?
You're out of my area of expertise here.
You must have a view, though, surely. Well,
I listened to the Prime Minister talk about, I think, in this room, was it on Monday? But I don't have anything to add to what he said. My area of relative competence is what's going on in the Chinese economy now, and it's recovered pretty well. It got on top of the virus quickly. It had big subsidies and support for producers, and unlike the advanced Western economies, it didn't focus on income support to households. It focused more on support to businesses, and that generated a big increase in production, and now that's starting to flow through to increased consumer spending. The Chinese equity market's been strong, interest rates have gone up, and the exchange rate's gone up. So the current Chinese economy is doing better. That's my area of expertise. Obviously, the tensions with China affect our own economy, but how they're going to be resolved, I think you're better listening to the Prime Minister than me.
Shane Wright.
Governor Shane Wright from The Age and the SMH. In the middle of 2019, a trio of RBA economists released a report, research on the so-called debt overhang effect, that people who, as they increased the amount of the size of their mortgages, even if the value of the house went up, it affected their household consumption. There was, these researchers from your own organisation found that as you lifted debt, consumption came down. You've got a huge amount of debt being held on by mortgage-ors at the moment. Is that an issue that you might see play out, given that you've got interest rates so low and you've committed to such a long period of time, that will feed into higher debt levels and that will then flow back into lower consumption once all the support disappears?
It's possible, but over the past year, debt levels for many people have actually declined. You've seen record balances being held in these offset accounts that people have against their mortgages and the redraw facilities. Every month we're surprised at how much has gone into those. So many people have used the extra government support and the fact they haven't been spending as much because they couldn't or they were cautious to pay down their debts. So I think that's a positive development. It's added to the resilience of the household sector. Their balance sheets are in better shape than they have been for some years. So that's where we are now. It's possible, certainly, that we could go through a period of rapid credit growth again and people start borrowing because interest rates are low and they want to buy houses. The issue, as I said in my prepared remarks, is are people doing that responsibly and carefully? And are the banks applying decent lending standards? In the last housing boom, lending standards deteriorated too much and APRA and the Council of Financial Regulators stepped in. If we saw anything like the same developments occur again, we would do the same. So it's a risk there, but there is a policy response if that risk starts to manifest itself, and something we're watching very carefully. At the moment, I'm not worried, but that could change.
John Keogh.
Thanks, Dr. Lowe. John Keogh from the Australian Financial Review. You've made the rather extraordinary pledge that you don't believe interest rates will rise for the next 3 to 4 years from the rock bottom 0.1%, which means potentially you may never raise interest rates in your 7 years as governor. Now, my question to you is, I understand the forward guidance value you get out of making that pledge, but how much confidence do you have in that, and how much credibility does it have Your own presentation today showed that we're easily outperforming the RBA central forecast and also its more optimistic upside forecasts. New Zealand today reported unemployment of just 4.9%, perhaps a good lead indicator for Australia. And we're getting asset price appreciation, and also there's going to be limited labour supply from immigration not being allowed over the next year or so, so maybe unemployment could fall even faster than we think. Is the 3 to 4 year pledge too good to be true?
Can I just take an issue with the word pledge? I haven't kind of pledged anything. All I've said is that, you know, we're going to keep interest rates where they are until inflation sustainably within 2 to 3%, and I don't think that's going to be until 24. So that's what I've said. You might have a different view, and you might think that inflation's going to get back there kind of next year, maybe. But that's not my view, so I'm just, you know, I'm big on kind of openness and transparency, so I wanted to share my view with you, but I'm certainly not pledging that. But I think there's a high degree of confidence that that will be the outcome. It's certainly possible, and I hope the unemployment rate comes down more quickly than we have forecast. But even if it does, we discuss both at the board and internally at the bank the experience before the pandemic when we had unemployment rates at 40 and 50 year lows in the US and the UK, and actually even in New South Wales we got an unemployment rate as low as it was in 73. And even then, wage growth was kind of two and a bit, increasing only very slowly. So there are some really powerful structural factors at work, not just in Australia, but globally. They relate to kind of globalisation of supply chains, which may be in reverse. They relate to technology, changes in the power between workers and firms. So they're really powerful structural factors that mean that you have to have a very tight labour market, low unemployment rates, to get wages increasing materially. You might have a different view to me about how quickly those structural factors will reverse, or maybe how quickly the unemployment rate will come down. But my judgment is the unemployment rate will come down, but not sufficiently quickly. And those structural factors are going to be with us for some years. There's another one working perhaps in the opposite direction, and that's the ageing of the population. But that's very slow moving. So I'm not pledging, but I'm giving you my best guess.
Andrew Tillett.
Andrew Tillett from the Financial Review and board director here at the Press Club. We currently have a situation where 2 million people in Perth are locked down for 5 days because of one case of the virus. We had Sydney effectively cauterised from the rest of the country over the Christmas period. I was wondering if you could give me a bit of an assessment of what sort of damage border closures actually have done to the economy, given that there is this sort of mixed feeling about, as Mark Kenny was alluding to, that, you know, if you get the health response right, the economy will look after itself. So the damage that's been done by that, and given that a definition of what should be a hotspot has proved elusive through the National Cabinet process, how important do you think it is to the economic recovery that we do sort of land at a consistent, nationally consistent approach to border closures?
And perhaps I can make two general points. The first would be that the lockdowns and the restrictions have not been as depressing on spending and activity as we thought they would be. Because what we discovered, we probably should have known this, that people find other ways to spend their money and to do their business, don't they? if in Perth you can't travel to Sydney, you might spend your money on something else. So people, there's tremendous resilience, adaptability and innovation in the way we go about doing things. So that has helped the economy, as I spoke about in my prepared remarks. I think the other general point, and this is something that I kind of feel in my job, in these public roles, you're having to make trade-offs all the time. You've got trade-offs between inflation and unemployment, housing prices, financial stability, and so as a public official, you're having to make trade-offs all the time. The premiers are having to make very, very difficult trade-offs, aren't they? That, you know, if they shut down now, they improve the health situation. Hopefully, in the end, that improves the economic situation. But in the short term, it imposes economic costs. And we know, I know this from my own experience, that the shutdowns impose personal costs on people. You can't see your family and friends. So there are all these type of trade-offs the politicians are having to make. and we can all sit there and criticise how they've calibrated those trade-offs, but by and large, the Australian political class, I think, has done a remarkably good job at managing those trade-offs. They're not perfectly, everyone here in this room will have a different view, but broad sweep, I think, given the difficulty of making trade-offs, they've done a pretty good job.
I'm getting close to time, but next question's from Tom Connell.
Tom Connell from Sky News. Governor, I thought I'd better throw one in about the old modern monetary theory debate because it rages on. We've got this huge amount at the moment, obviously, of bonds being bought. Last time around during the GFC, perhaps the inflation a lot of people predicted didn't come. But if it does at some point, obviously a massive or a spike in inflation is a pretty bad thing for an economy. Are you looking at any other warning signs aside from just inflation itself as to whether that's a threat in the future given all the government bond buying at the moment?
Well, just for clarity, we're not involved in modern monetary theory, which is the central bank directly financing the government. We don't do that. We will not do that. It's not even on our radar screen. So you may have heard me before say modern monetary theory, there's not much monetary, not much modern, not much theory in it. But the more substantive part of your question was, is there inflation risk that's more serious than the one I've been articulating? It's possible. I think it's very unlikely, again, because to have sustained increases in inflation, we've got to have sustained increases in wages. And for the reasons I was talking about before, I just don't see that on the horizon. It's possible that we do get some pockets where there are price increases because demand is strong. As I was saying to my colleagues this morning, the laws of demand and supply still work. We know that. When people have bought a lot of homewares in the last little while, the price of homewares are rising at the fastest rate in a decade. And some other consumer goods, the price of electrical goods, are kind of where we're falling at the slowest rate in a decade, is because there's been strong demand. So we could see adjustments or interruptions to the balance between supply and demand that cause some prices to rise quite quickly. But do I worry about a generalised outbreak of inflation? No, because I think the wage dynamics are such that it's hard to see wages returning to 4% growth. Now, I'm hopeful in the medium term to deliver the society, or it won't be me, but the central bank delivers inflation rates of 2.5% on average. There's at least 1% labour productivity growth. That would mean wages growing at 3.5% and hopefully a bit more. It seems a long way away, doesn't it, to have wages growing at 4% when they're growing at 1.25%.
Absolutely.
Could change. You know, we know a lot of things change quickly in this world, but this is not one that I'm expecting to change quickly.
Final question today is from Tim Shaw.
Thanks, Laura. Tim Shaw, Dr. Lowe, Director of the National Press Club. You've spoken about responsible lending practices and the importance of being able to keep that in check. We don't want a repeat of some of the practices of the past. Can we talk about the responsible borrowing practices of state and territory governments? In the context of their debt levels, the Commonwealth's been investing nationally, as we know, during the COVID pandemic. Can you run a ruler over the states and territories, their capacity to borrow? Because it was only a little while ago that we were going to be back in the black federally. Mm. What's your view about the investment practices and the borrowing practices of states and territories here in the Commonwealth?
Well, I have been both publicly and privately encouraging the states to spend more, mm-hmm. particularly on public investment. So I can hardly criticise the borrowing that they're doing to fund that, and I wouldn't be inclined to criticise them either, because they've played a very important role in the national fiscal response, and particularly over the next year or so, the infrastructure programs they're rolling out, it's going to support jobs, help the economy, and it's entirely appropriate they borrow to do that. Most of them, and this is the same for the federal government, have not baked in permanently high levels of spending. I think that's quite important that governments don't do that. You can only have permanently high level of spending if you have permanently high level of taxes, and there's obviously a disinclination to do that. So you shouldn't have permanently high level of spending. But during a once-in-a-century pandemic, it's exactly the right thing to do, to borrow against our future income build the infrastructure we need and then to pay that debt down gradually over time. It's exactly what they should be doing. I've been encouraged by what the state governments have done in response to the pandemic. I think it's proportionate, sensible and affordable.